forces in West Asia creates insecurity. And Azerbaijan and ethnic Armenians in the Nagorno-Karabakh region agree to stop fighting a day after Baku launched a military operation there. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Iran's leader says the West, including the U.S., was seeking the collapse of the Islamic Revolution by backing the former Iraqi dictator during his war on the Iranian nation. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said all world powers assisted Saddam Hussein to wage the war. He said France and Germany had provided Saddam with most advanced weapons. The leader underlined that certain Arab states also helped the former Iraqi regime with financial aid and logistics. He said Iranian families sacrificed their sons and daughters to defend their beloved country. But the leader added the war made Iran more firm as the country succeeded in promoting the culture of resistance. He noted that Iran's active presence in West Asia has been frightening the U.S., its allies, and puppets. Ayatollah Khamenei was addressing a group of veterans and activists of the Iran-Iraq war and resistance ahead of the Sacred Defense Week. Iran's president has delivered his speech at the 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly. Ebrahim Raisi says a new world order is taking shape across the globe, which will remain irreversible.
We are at a determining juncture, a historic juncture. Today, the world is moving towards an emerging world, and this trend, this path, is not reversible. The aging liberal order, which serves the interests of domineering powers, which used to serve their interests, it does not exist anymore. And in one word, the project to Americanize the world has failed.
Raisi said the world will not accept the Western hegemony any longer. The Iranian president said some Western powers have the Cold War mentality, fan the flames of conflict, and seek to undermine the well-being of other nations. He said Iran has played a key role in foiling the plots of hegemonic powers. Raisi further said the presence of foreign forces in West Asia creates insecurity. He described the Israeli regime as the main source of instability and insecurity in the region. The president also hailed anti-terror efforts of late Iranian commander General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike in Iraq in January 2020.
The security today for some countries in our region, they owe their security to the struggles by martyr Soleimani. And if it hadn't been for the bravery of Lieutenant General Soleimani, he was a hero of fighting terrorism. If it hadn't been for his struggles, many regions would have burned in the fire set by the Daesh terrorist group.
Raisi said Iran will use all the capacities at its disposal to bring to justice those who were involved in General Soleimani's assassination. He also blamed Western countries for using terrorism as a tool to advance their foreign policy goals. Raisi said some European countries have become a safe haven for anti-Tehran terror groups, such as the MKO, which has killed more than 17,000 Iranians. He also condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran and Islamophobia in Europe. Further in his remarks, the Iranian president stressed that Iran will not give up its right to use peaceful nuclear technology.
Nuclear weapons have no place in Iran's defense doctrine. Official reports by relevant international authorities, as well as Western intelligence agencies, they have time and again actually confirmed this claim, the authenticity of this claim. Iran, over the past two decades, has never, ever given up its right to use and will never give up its right to use nuclear technology for peaceful purposes.
The Iranian president played down the impact of U.S. sanctions on the country's progress, highlighting the failure of the maximum pressure campaign launched by the former U.S. administration against Tehran. Rice, he also warned Europe would be a closer, would rather, excuse me, be a loser if it chooses the path of confrontation in dealing with the Islamic Republic over its nuclear case. For more on that story, we're now joined by senior fellow at the Chongyang Institute at Renmin University of China, Mr. John Ross, who's joining us from the British capital, London. Mr. Ross, welcome to the program. Iran's president, he delivered his speech at the 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly. President Raisi says a new world order is taking shape across the globe, which will remain irreversible. Do you see it in that light as well?
Yes, but it's taking shape, but there are great dangers to it. I mean, what is basically happening is a whole series of countries are economically developing. So, certainly China, a large number of developing countries, the so-called global south. The global north, particularly the United States, is growing very slowly because the United States is the main economy in the global north, and therefore a new world order is taking place. The great danger is that the United States, which is losing in peaceful economic competition, will decide to use its military strength to try to reverse this process. So I would agree that a new world order is taking shape, but also there are considerable dangers posed in the situation.
Let's also talk about the economic aspect of all of this. Of course, the Iranian president said that the world will not accept the Western hegemony any longer. One aspect of the waning hegemony of the West is embedded in the economic aspect. We're seeing different blocs across the globe trying to de-dollarize or lessen their dependence on the dollar as the main global currency. We can name BRICS for one. There's the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. How important, how fundamental is dissipation of the Western hegemony when it comes to the issue of world economy?
Well, there's two processes which are taking place. One of which is, as regards its weight within the world economy, the United States has been in decline for, in real terms, for 50 years, and that's hasn't changed. Even the IMF, which can't be accused of being anti-US, projects that the main driving forces of the global economy in the next period will be in the global south. The dangers in the situation, however, as I said, the United States will try to reverse this by military means, and also it's carrying out various sanctions, technology boycotts, and other things of that type. Therefore, when looked at the two de-dollarization, there's two real processes. One is it's becoming increasingly urgent for a large number of countries to find a way of getting around the various sanctions carried out by the US on the dollar, and that's why you've seen all sorts of things on this. Iran is getting able to get around these sanctions. Argentina recently took a loan from China in RMB in order to avoid having to use the dollar, etc. The second is the question of and that is very, very important. The question of general de-dollarization, I would like to say that that's going to happen, but I don't think it's going to happen in the short term. But an increasing range of countries are going to be will find ways to get around the US sanctions because it's against their interests, and the US is going against what is the mainstream in the world economy.
All right, thanks a lot, John Ross, joining us from the British capital, London. Elsewhere, Iran's defense minister says Tehran and Moscow have seen an unprecedented expansion in their defense and security ties. Over the past decade, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtian said that cooperation between the two countries will lead to peace and stability in the international arena. Ashtian also pointed out that significant changes in the world order. The top defense official made the remarks during a meeting with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Shoigu. For his part, the Russian defense chief noted that Moscow-Tehran cooperation is reaching new highs. Despite sanctions, he also stated Russia's preparedness to take further joint steps to strengthen stability and security in West Asia. Shoigu arrived in the Iranian capital earlier on Tuesday for talks with senior Iranian officials. The prisoner swap deal between the U.S. and Iran has taken place. Five prisoners from each country has been freed. That's the only common denominator when it comes to this release. While Iran has found it to be its duty to defend the rights of its citizens on humanitarian grounds, the U.S. has blasted Iran as being a bad actor. There's a stark contrast to how Iran views diplomacy as opposed to the U.S. Putting aside the vast mistrust between the two, Iran respects another country's sovereignty, while the U.S. jails Iranians because of alleged circumvention of illegal U.S. sanctions. Iran justifiably jails people suspected of spying and collaborating with foreign governments like the U.S.
An emotional reunion. Two of the five Iranians illegally detained by the U.S. have returned to the Islamic Republic, their homeland, reunited with their family. The crime? Conducting business, which the U.S. claimed had violated U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, the five prisoners held in Iranian jails have also been freed. Their crime, far more serious than just conducting business. They were charged with spying. The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his team conducted very difficult behind-the-scenes talks, an arduous task since Iran and the U.S. cannot negotiate directly. Thanks to mediators in Qatar and in Oman, the release has taken place. This was deemed as a great accomplishment for the Raisi administration on humanitarian grounds. The Iranian president has promised that it would safeguard Iranians' rights and fight for Iran's rights at any cost. Incredible double standards are at play in the way Western media covered this story. It seems like the media forgot that the U.S. had imprisoned Iranians, illegally at that, in their prisons, emotionally covering the released prisoners from Iran, while condemning Iran and its officials. Not even scant coverage of the prisoners of the bereaved families on the Iranian side. One of the prisoners held by Iran on spying charges, Siamak Namazi, was a businessman held since 2015. He thanked the U.S. President Joe Biden for ultimately putting the lives of American citizens above politics, as if the Iranian president had not done that. But the politics Namazi is talking about is out of U.S.'s own doing. The sanctions-obsessed U.S. uses its sanctions policy to twist the arm of nations into following its foreign policy line. Even on the day of the prisoner release, U.S. sanctioned the former president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He was Iran's president 10 years ago. Additionally, the U.S. sanctioned Iran's intelligence ministry, and just days before that, it had sanctioned 29 individuals and entities in connection with what it claimed was violent suppression of nationwide protest, including Press TV. In the case of Siamak Namazi, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison for espionage and cooperation with the U.S. government and foreign intelligence networks. His company, Atiyeh Bahar Consulting in Tehran, was associated covertly acting with the U.S. government's companies anti-Iranian in nature, like the VOA TV channel, the U.S. government's Institute for National Strategic Studies, INSS, at the Pentagon's National Defense University, and the Office of Iranian Affairs at the U.S. State Department.
A Yemeni delegation accompanied by Omani mediators has returned home after 5 days of negotiations with Saudi officials in Riyadh. An official from Yemen's Ansar al-Movement has described the talks as positive and serious to resolve the outstanding issues. Ali al-Qulhum said the two sides would hold new round of talks, but he did not give details. This is the first visit by Ansar representatives to Saudi Arabia since the onset of the war on Yemen in 2015. Meanwhile, the Saudi Foreign Ministry said the positive results of the negotiations could help reach a roadmap for peace. Before the talks in Riyadh, Ansarullah's top negotiator had said humanitarian issues would be the focus of negotiations. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has claimed tens of thousands of lives and destroyed much of the country's infrastructure. Azerbaijan and ethnic Armenians in the Nagorno-Karabakh region have agreed to stop fighting a day after Baku launched a military operation there. The two sides agreed to a Russian proposal for a ceasefire. Ethnic Armenians in Karabakh agreed to lay down their arms. Baku earlier said it would stop what it called an anti-terrorist operation if ethnic Armenian separatists surrendered. More than 30 people were killed and over 200 wounded in less than 24 hours of Azerbaijan's operation. The Nagorno-Karabakh region is populated mainly by Armenians, but it's an internationally recognized part of Azerbaijan. The two countries have fought several wars over the region. Azerbaijan recaptured swaths of land in and around it in a 2020 war. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Stay tuned, though. Bye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this episode, we invite you to listen to the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the Supreme Assembly of Commanders and Officials of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, on August 17, 2023. In the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya. The enemy wishes to interfere in the country's security. It wishes to disrupt people's lives. That is what the enemy is doing. Well, the main perpetrators are, of course, the CIA, Mossad, MI6, and the other spy agencies. They are the main perpetrators. But they also have underlinings inside and outside the country who are Western-oriented or are indifferent. But the spy services are the main perpetrators and they are the ringleaders. Our duty today is to continuously safeguard the revolution. Our duty today is to maintain national unity. National unity is important. Our duty today is to encourage people to participate in things. We need to help people, especially the lower classes. Our officials have a duty today to engage in jihadi work. This is not limited to the IRGC. All of the country's officials have a duty to take part in jihadi work. They need to work tirelessly around the clock. We have passed through a large part of this chapter. We have climbed up this steep incline and passed the steepest part, and we are approaching the mountaintop. We must not get tired.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today is not the day to be tired. It is not the day to give up hope. Today is a day for enthusiasm, hope, and movement. The country's officials in different departments should move forward with this kind of spirit. There should be trust. I'm not saying there should not be criticism. Criticism should exist alongside trust. It's all right if the people want to criticize, but there should also be trust. Our officials are working hard. They are working with sincerity, with interest, with enthusiasm, with all the might, and with trust in Allah. They need to be trusted and criticized if necessary. I'm not opposed to criticism. If you follow this path, and thank God it has pursued up until today and will continue to be followed by God's grace, then victory over the enemy is certain. May God's blessings, greetings, mercy be upon you all. Allah
things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The UN Migration Agency, IOM, has raised the alarm over the high number of migrants killed while crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. It has described the U.S.-Mexico border as the world's deadliest land route for migrants. At least 686 deaths and disappearances were reported in the border crossing last year. The figure represents nearly half of the 1,457 migrant deaths and disappearances recorded through the Americas in 2022, the deadliest year on record since IOM's Missing Migrants Project began in 2014. The data underscores the growing death toll and increasing risks that migrants face throughout the region. These figures represent the lowest estimates available, as many more deaths are likely to go unrecorded due to a lack of data from official sources. Nearly half of the deaths on the U.S.-Mexico border were linked to the hazardous crossing of the Sonoran and the Chihuahuan deserts, far more than other desert regions where irregular migration is prevalent.
The International Organization for Migration documented the deaths and disappearances of 686 migrants on the U.S.-Mexico border in 2022, making it the deadliest land route for migrants worldwide last year. The figure represents nearly half of the 1,457 migrant deaths and disappearances recorded throughout the Americas last year, the deadliest on record since the Missing Migrants Project began in 2014.
Hundreds of thousands of migrants and asylum seekers have taken long and perilous paths through South and Central America and Mexico in hopes of reaching the U.S. border to apply for protection. Many are fleeing rampant gang violence, poverty, political persecution, and other crises in their home countries. This is while the U.S. is accused of ignoring the plight of migrants. From an economic perspective, it is the U.S. that benefits from the contribution of migrants to the nation's GDP. Many of those immigrants that come to the U.S. through its southern borders end up working in farms and construction sites owned by big companies. It's been argued that increased immigration promotes U.S. economic growth and helps tackle labor shortages and inflation. U.S. President Joe Biden, who is under pressure from Republicans, has launched new restrictions and programs to discourage people from trying to apply for asylum at the frontier. The measures have been put in place amid record numbers of arrivals at the border since he took office in early 2021. The measures introduced by the Biden administration include a rule that disqualifies people from seeking asylum in the U.S. if they did not first apply in countries that they crossed earlier in their journeys. Rights groups have slammed the measure as an asylum ban. The Biden administration has also opened so-called safe mobility centers in Latin America to allow asylum seekers to apply for U.S. protection in third countries instead of at the border with Mexico. But migrants and asylum seekers continue to head to the border. For years, Central American nations have stepped up immigration enforcement efforts, often at the behest of the United States, erecting new obstacles for the steady stream of people making the journey north. The journey is plagued with violence, with areas under the control of criminal networks and armed groups.
The Darien Gap, an inhospitable jungle border crossing between Panama and Colombia saw 141 documented migrant deaths in 2022. The remote and dangerous nature of this area and the presence of criminal gangs along the route means that this figure likely does not represent the actual number of lives lost.
The surge in arrivals has piled political pressure on the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, whose Republican rivals have accused him of causing chaos at the border. In 2021, U.S. authorities reportedly detained 1.7 million migrants trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border.
Let me be clear. The lifting of the Title 42 public health order does not mean our border is open. In fact, it is the contrary. Our use of our immigration enforcement authorities under Title 8 of the United States Code means tougher consequences for people who cross the border illegally.
Marking an all-time high and highlighting the deepening political and humanitarian challenges the Biden administration is facing on immigration, the U.S. has been increasingly reliant on Mexico to stem the flow of migrants. As it returns to Mexico, the majority of people who arrive at the border under a Trump-era border restriction enacted due to the coronavirus pandemic.
$10 an hour, 5 years seniority.
One of the striking auto workers in the U.S. Thousands of United Auto Workers are officially on a strike after three Detroit automakers failed to reach an agreement with the union.
What appears that now is going to happen is the UAW is planning targeted strikes across all three companies. So striking at just specific plants.
We're going to get to that story soon. But did you know that the U.S. is experiencing strikes in other sectors as well? From UPS, the carrier service, to Starbucks, the coffee chain,
we pull the shots.
We call the shots.
Workers at many U.S. companies are taking to the streets. In short, they are fighting for better pay and improved working conditions.
We have hotel workers on strike across the region, everywhere from the L.A. Grand, which joined the strike this morning, J.W. Marriott, Ritz-Carlton.
We have a very weak labor law. There are a lot of aspects of our economy and our politics that concentrate a lot of power in the hands of corporations.
And there may be more strikes to come. UPS employees started striking before reaching a deal. That would have involved some 340,000 workers. Close to 3,000 Starbucks workers protested what they called unfair labor practices. 1,400 members of the United Electrical Workers went on a strike after rejecting the company's contract offer. 6,000 workers at Boeing's Aerosystems went on a strike, also rejecting the company's contract offer. Add to that 80 Amazon drivers who protested unfair labor practices. And McDonald's employees in California went on a strike over paid sick leave. Well, it becomes evident how much of a common occurrence these strikes are. And we can't forget Hollywood. General Motors, Ford Motor Company, and Chrysler, well-known names in the car industry, brand names with record incomes, but not so for the average worker.
They should be paid more. The corporation is making billions of dollars. And these people have been with them and the cost of living and stuff like that. They've been with this company 20, 30 years.
Tens and thousands of the United Auto Workers are officially on a strike. The three Detroit automakers have failed to reach an agreement with the union, which represents about 146,000 workers. One major issue on the table, workers' pay. The union has proposed 40% hourly pay increases over the next 4 years. The average U.S. auto worker on a manufacturing production line earns about $28 per hour as of August. That's up only $1 from the previous year. The problem began on an agreement that the auto workers made with the government, which bailed out the big three automakers. The problem is, the workers hired in 2007 or earlier earned an average of $33 per hour, but the ones hired after 2007 earn only $17 an hour. Why? Because this agreement was made as a goodwill gesture to help the automakers get back on their feet after the crisis. But now auto workers' hourly earnings have fallen 19.3% since 2007. And that is not fair as they see it. Even the U.S. politicians see it that way, like Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
The fight you are waging here is not just about decent wages and working conditions and pensions in the automobile industry. It is a fight to take on corporate greed and tell the people on top this country belongs to all of us, not just a few.
But strikes in the U.S. are happening at a more frequent pace compared to previous years. There were 424 work stoppages in 2022, including 417 strikes and 7 lockouts. Work stoppages increased by 52% from 2021 to 2022. The number of workers involved in work stoppages increased by 60% from 2021 to 2022. The number of striking workers as a consequence saw an increase. Since the year 2021, the numbers have been rising steadily, with 650,000 to have threatened to go on a strike so far this year. The strikes point to a deeper problem within the U.S. economy. Things are not that rosy when it comes to Americans' income and economic well-being. For example, homelessness has been on the rise in several states, most notably California, and also in New York City.
The unhoused population has exploded with the addition of the new arrivals. For example, here at St. Bartholomew's Church, where we start serving, we're seeing on average anywhere from 250 to 275 people, more or less regularly. Once the new arrivals started coming, our numbers got up over 400 people.
President Ebrahim Raisi has underscored Iran's full authority on its recently released assets. Raisi said it is the Islamic Republic that decides how to spend the funds and that the money will be spent, quote, wherever we need it.
This money belongs to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and naturally we will decide, the Islamic Republic of Iran will decide to spend it wherever we need it.
So if I hear you clearly, that it will be used for more than humanitarian purposes in your view?
Humanitarian means whatever the Iranian people needs. So this money will be budgeted for those needs. And the needs of the Iranian people will be decided and determined by the Iranian government.
Raisi made the remarks in an exclusive interview with the American broadcast television network NBC in the capital, Tehran. He pointed to the last month's deal between Iran and the United States to exchange prisoners and to secure the release of $6 billion U.S. dollars of Iranian funds that had remained blocked in two South Korean banks since 2018 because of U.S. pressure on Seoul. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden claimed at the time that the funds and the proceeds of Iranian oil sales to South Korea could only be spent on humanitarian purposes.
The system is set up such that this money, these funds, can only be parceled out for humanitarian purposes.
The Biden administration has announced that it had taken concrete steps to clear the way for the prisoner exchange and also issuing a waiver that allows international banks to transfer the $6 billion to Qatar without the threat of U.S. sanctions. The waiver means that European, Middle Eastern and Asian banks will not be in violation of U.S. sanctions in converting Iran's money, which was frozen in South Korea, and transferring it to Qatar's central bank, where it will be held for Tehran. Top Iranian officials have emphasized that there is no connection between the prisoner exchange agreement reached with the United States and the release of Iran's frozen assets. U.S. sanctions have mostly targeted Iran's sale of crude oil and its ability to engage in dollar transactions in the global banking system. The Iranian funds were illegally blocked under the pretext of U.S. sanctions.
Meanwhile, Iran's permanent mission to the United Nations has confirmed that five Iranians detained illegally in the United States on charges of circumventing U.S. sanctions will soon be released as part of a prisoner swap deal between Tehran and Washington. The five Iranian detainees were identified as Kaveh Lutfullah Afrasiabi, Mehrdad Muin Ansari, Amin Hassanzadeh, Reza Sarhangpour Kofrani, and Kambiz Attar Kashani. The prisoner exchange agreement was officially announced on August 10th, following 2 years of indirect negotiations between Tehran and Washington. In a gesture of goodwill, Iran has moved four American detainees from prison to house arrest. They joined the fifth American who was already under house arrest in Tehran. Meanwhile, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has expressed the Islamic Republic's readiness to negotiate last year's draft agreement aimed at salvaging the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with the JCPOA, and removing illegal U.S. sanctions. Amir Abdollahian underscored the current administration's efforts to neutralize Western-led sanctions against the Islamic Republic while keeping the window open for negotiations to remove the illegal U.S. bans. The United States, under former President Donald Trump, abandoned the JCPOA in May 2018 and reinstated sanctions that the agreement had lifted. The talks to revive the 2015 deal kicked off in the Austrian capital city of Vienna in April 2021 with the intention of removing anti-Iran sanctions and examining the U.S. seriousness in rejoining the JCPOA. The discussions, however, have been at a standstill since August 2022 due to Washington's insistence on its hard-nosed position of not removing all the sanctions that were slapped on Tehran by the previous U.S. administration.
What the Americans want to do is have a JCPOA where they don't abide by their commitments in full, and the Iranians do so. And the Iranians are not going to have that again. When Obama signed the deal, he systematically violated the deal from day one. And then Trump tore up the deal. And Biden, despite criticizing Trump, he pursued Trump's maximum pressure policy, which was directed at ordinary Iranians.
Iran has consistently said that it has not left the negotiations with the Western side and that it was the United States which has blocked the talks with its excessive demands.
Iran's leader, addressing thousands of people from the provinces of Sistan and Balochistan and South Khorasan. He also said the U.S. and Europe do not have the same powers as before and are declining. The leader may be referring to the rise of powerful blocs like BRICS or the SCO. BRICS in particular has just recently expanded from its current five members to include new members like Iran and Saudi Arabia. And here's a map of the world outlining BRICS countries. It is pretty obvious how the U.S. and Europe are the minority. U.S. intervention in other countries' affairs, whether through wars, regime change, or economic sanctions, has led to the polarization of the world. The leader called the U.S. failure in Syria and the humiliating escape from Afghanistan two obvious examples of the decline of American power. It's a toss-up between which of these two failures were more humiliating. Right now, the U.S. is occupying Syria, looting the country from its oil and selling it to provide for its troops there, and by many accounts, to support the terrorists in northern Syria. That is a low for any country. A big slap in the face to France and colonialism. From Mali to Niger to Gabon, African countries are rising against the colonial country France, which has held these countries captive economically. But the people of these countries have now risen, saying that enough is enough. Iran's leader has said you hear these days how the African countries that were under the influence of France are rising against it one after another. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader stated that Washington is working on ethnic and sectarian fault lines in Iran with the aim of creating a crisis in the country. Some of the areas that he outlined, called crisis points, are ethnic differences, religious differences, and the issue of gender and women. But this is something that the U.S. has executed for quite some time. Back in the year 2007, it was revealed that the CIA was funding ethnic separatist groups to create instability in Iran. These incidents were carried out by the Kurds in the west, the Azeris in the northwest, the Ahwazi Arabs in the southwest, and the Baluchis in the southeast. The incidents included bombing and assassination campaigns against Iranian soldiers and government officials. There was also the Iran Freedom Support, an act of Congress approved by the former U.S. President George W. Bush, that appropriated millions of dollars to spend money in support of groups opposed to the Iranian government. Iran's leader statements have come at a time when there is an intense campaign to turn the unfortunate passing away of Mahsa Amini's one-year anniversary into a violent one.
The commission is the premier UN body for promoting gender equality and empowering women. It cannot do its important work if it's being undermined from within. Iran's membership at this moment is an ugly stain on the commission's credibility.
One member, a bullying member, notorious for disobeying the UN Charter and international law, intend to pursue its unlawful request to remove an elected member from the commission only on the basis of unfounded claims and fabricated arguments.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام يا ابن آدم ما كسبت فوق قوتك فأنت فيه خازن لغيرك.
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, O son of Adam, whatever you earn beyond your basic needs, you will only keep vigil over it for others.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother. Now, George Jordak writes in his book, in the testament written by Ali for Malik al-Ashtar, one of his close companions, while appointing him as a governor of Egypt, Imam Ali says, appoint that person as a commander of your army, whom you consider to be most sincere and superior to others in the matter of humbleness and forbearance. This person should not be short-tempered and should accept an excuse from the people. This person should be kind to the weak, yet hard upon the powerful and oppressive. This person should not become hot-tempered due to the cruelty of the people and should not become helpless due to the weakness. And so George Jordak writes, thus it is evident, it is proved, that Ali was a peace-loving person. And he always recommended peace. It is so interesting that a Christian brother has reached this conclusion, like the day shines upon the earth, that Imam Ali was a peace-loving person. And yet, on the other hand, we have so many so-called Muslims who wrongfully say that Imam Ali was a war-loving person. So interesting that how has time changed that a Christian brother can teach us so much about Imam Ali alayhi salam. And George Jordak continues and he writes, Ali extremely hated war and always prohibited it. He never stepped towards war unless war itself stepped towards him. And even if he stepped towards war, it was when he had exhausted all efforts to stop it by means of friendship, love, goodness, and kindness. George Jordak writes, if Ali was compelled to fight a battle, he tried that the least number of people should be killed. And when Ali secured victory over his enemies, he forgave them. He was equally grieved in the event of victory and of defeat. George Jordak writes, whenever Imam Ali's enemies requested for peace, he quickly acceded to this request, cheerfully and wholeheartedly. George Jordak writes, Imam Ali used to say, during peacetime, the soldiers are in comfort, the worries of the people are less, and an atmosphere of security prevails in the cities. George Jordak writes, Imam Ali sent many orders to the governors and the officers in which he emphatically recommended to them, inter alia, that they should follow Imam Ali's example and should not draw their swords on account of ordinary manners, as was done by the people during the age of ignorance, Jahiliyyah. George Jordak writes, Imam Ali says, do not put your hands and swords in motion like the tongue on account of trivial matters. Imam Ali says, I do not punish anyone merely on account of suspicion. I shall not fight anyone until I invite him to peace and thus discharge my responsibility in this behalf. Imam Ali continues, as George Jordak writes, if that person repents, I shall accept his repentance. But if he declines to do so and is bent upon fighting, I shall seek help from God and shall fight against him. George Jordak writes, it is the duty of every person to abide by the promises made by him. And it is by this means peace is attained between the individuals and in the society, and the chances of warfare are eliminated. A covenant should be honored, whether it is concluded between the followers of the same religions or different religions, between persons belonging to the same race or to different races, and between friends or enemies. George Jordak finally writes, this was the principle which was followed constantly throughout his life by Imam Ali alayhi salam. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. This moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أشهد أنك جاهدت في الله حق جهاده وعملت بكتابه واتبعت سنن نبيه.
I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him and used His discretion to take you away and sealed your enemies' doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you. O Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which Thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which Thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember Thee and invoke Thee. Let me be in love with Thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of Thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of Thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying Thee. Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. Do you want to be healthy and feel good? Perhaps you won't find anyone not sharing this goal. Whilst there's a plethora of advice online and by experts, we have wonderful recommendations in Islamic teachings, including the sayings of the Holy Ahlul Bayt alayhum assalam. They all lived a healthy life and would love their followers to be healthy too. For instance, I have personally found hundreds of narrations on healthy lifestyle from the Commander of the Faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam. Here are tips in this regard. Personal hygiene. Imam alayhi salam recommends that the nails are trimmed every Friday. In a hadith found in the book Tibbul Imma, Medicine of the Imams, he reportedly said, such a deed protects against illness. Similarly, in book Makarimul Akhlaq, Imam Ali alayhi salam is reported to have stated, removing the underarm hair reduces unpleasant smells. It is indeed the sunnah and a source of purification and what the Prophet has commanded. Food that Imam Ali alayhi salam recommends. Through looking at various sources, I found narrations pointing to what Amir al-Mu'mineen, peace be upon him, used to eat and what he would recommend you and I to actually eat. Green vegetables, eggs, starting with a little bit of salt before eating, pomegranate, bread, vinegar,
vegetable oils, dates, honey, and milk, amongst many others, were mentioned by Amir al-Mu'mineen in narrations. In an interesting narration, Imam Ali alayhi salam encourages eating oats mixed with water or milk, like a porridge, known as harisa. Eat the harisa, he says, for it gives you strength for worship for 40 days, and it was the food that was descended upon Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Number 9, water. Despite many of us not drinking enough water these days, Imam Ali alayhi salam recommends that excessive water consumption should be avoided as well. He tells us, don't make your hearts die with excessive food and drink, for the heart dies like a plant if you drink too much water. Finally, some vices that are related to health. The commander of the faithful, peace be upon him, warns of the impact of some spiritual vices on the body and health in general. For example, it is narrated that he said, the envious person is sick, even if his body is healthy. Similarly, he is reported to have said, to have hatred towards others results in ongoing illness. He also warns of the impact of stress and the need to de-stress to avoid illness. He stated, stress dissolves the body. Or in another narration, sadness destroys the body. These are some of the gems from the statements of a man who is truly a role model for each and every human being, and the best student of Rasulullah Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala grant us the permission to follow in his footsteps.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Black and white.
La migración forma parte de la propia
historia. Migration is part of human history. Perhaps we could not understand the humankind without migrations. However, we immediately think of the consequences of such a phenomenon. We think of incredible shipwrecks on the Mediterranean shores with children on board. We think of ships and boats sinking off in special areas. We think of refugees held captive. So it's a very shocking incident. For instance, the International Organization for Migration, dependent on the United Nations, reports that there were 261 million migrants in 2022. According to the International Labor Organization, there are 170 million migrant workers as of 2017, who make up 5% of the global workforce and generate 10% of the world's gross product.
Generan el 10% del producto bruto mundial.
The highly qualified workers go to the United States and Western Europe. 30% to 35% of these migrants choose Great Britain. 30% of doctors are foreigners in the United States. There is 50% of qualified foreign engineers in the U.S. That is a brain drain and also a form of exploitation of the people. We have already mentioned that there are different reasons for migration, and climate change is one of them. Some think that migration is a romantic phenomenon,
but it is not like that at all. There are different motives behind migration. For instance, economic sanctions and criminal blockades to suffocate nations